ready. It's time to forge the narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. We are the Battle of All Souls podcast. This is episode 179. I'm joined today by Andrew Whitaker and Chris Morgan.
Like a rock star.
Justin Troop and Ricky Addington.
What's up, guys?
Loving that new Stormcast Eternals book, right?
I think CeeLo is in that.
I've been seeing that. Thank you, Facebook.
Oh, man. I don't know what I like. I like more the comparison with the Sanguinor or the fact that someone was saying, nah, he's probably got better stats than that guy.
It's not very often that you get a topical Grammys joke on Forge the Narrative. So no,
definitely not.
Brava.
Is that what it's from?
It was uncomfortable to look at.
It looks uncomfortable to wear.
Yeah.
I don't know what statement he was making, but it's made. It's out there.
I think he was just celebrating the new Power Rangers movie coming out. Big Goldar fan. Paul, you're too old. You're too old to remember Goldar, aren't you? I think you missed that one.
It must have been right after my time.
Yeah.
You want to talk about gummy bears?
Oh, my God. They were totally bouncing here and bouncing everywhere. I don't know if you guys knew that. But
a rich backstory. almost as deep as 40K.
I feel like we're missing an inside joke here. Gummy bears, like the candy?
No, Andrew.
There was a cartoon series called Gummy Bears. Andrew, he's a bit young to
That was before my time.
It was amazing. I loved it.
Yeah, like four or five seasons. I don't remember exactly. We have a lot to say in a short amount of time. We have Justin Troop and I did a segment with Cool Mini or Not that we're going to put on to the end of this segment. And so stay tuned after we cut to break and come back with Michael Chenal from Cool Mini or Not and just talks about some of the cool stuff they've got going on right now. Some of the Kickstarters have just wrapped up, some updates on where some shipping and stuff is for folks, and then just kind of some insight into some of their projects. And I thought it was a cool talk.
Dude, so passionate. Like, and you can tell, like, there was like an intensity about him, about his passion. It was so awesome to talk to him. Great interview. I can't wait to listen to it, like, you know, edited and pretty.
Well, hopefully. As I promised, we're going to talk about finishing moves coming out first here because we missed it on the last one again because time being what it is, things are going to start normaling out after some big tournaments coming up. Adepticon's coming up in 40 days or something like that, 30-something days.
Ooh.
Yeah. Who's counting?
Everyone
is counting.
This unpainted display board I'm staring at right now is counting. It's got his.
Speaking of tournaments coming up, Paul, are you coming to the Atlanta 40K series on Saturday?
I will be there.
You will be there. All right.
It's a massive undertaking. I've been posting work in progress shots on Twitter at warmaster_TPM. And you can see some of the things. And it's basically a bunch of kitbashes. I think it's turning out pretty well. To paint this thing is going to be intimidating, but I will do it. And I will say that a lot of the topics that we talk about here translate and make their way into, you know, actual painting. So, and it's really cool to hear people share their experiences with that kind of stuff as well. So I want to get right into the finished moves. And I know we did weathering before, but I want to talk specifically about rust.
Crinkly and orange and awesome.
And flaky.
Rust can be, you know, you can do it a lot of different ways. But with the way I like to do rust is in layers. Everything looks better in layers. But with this type of stuff, they're so easy to accomplish. You're not... It's not like you're painting a base coat and then going up with a highlight color or like anything like that. You can get pretty aggressive and almost sloppy with it. And I prefer to use a sponge or a stipple brush for my technique.
Yeah, I tend to use an old dry brush, something where the bristles are all stiff and warped a little bit. Just not something like new or crisp, I guess you could say.
You can go right to the GWO technical paint of Rizzo Rust. That stuff does exactly like it's promised to do. It's perfect. Like most of the technical paints just do, they sell themselves, essentially. They do exactly what they say they're going to do.
And that's the RYZA Rust, is that right?
Yeah, I always call it Ryza Rust. But yeah, that stuff is, it is
my rust
really nice. Oh, my bad. Yeah, okay.
I'm not sure that there's a correct way to understand. For people looking it up who type in that, I wanted to make sure we had that covered. But I think it's an excellent technical paint. It's my go-to for rust, honestly.
I'm gonna hit you with the one piece of advice for it, and that's less is more. Start off and add. You can't go back with that stuff, but you can always go forward. So
layers.
Start real light, and then build up to where you want.
Well, that's part of what I want to talk about here, because he's going to mention that, you know, with the sponge, or, you know, I'm talking about a piece of pluck foam. So, like, I guess step one is go get some sable foam, some RB transport foam. And then you've got all this you've got a lifetime supply of sponge material to use in modeling.
Yeah, I've got an entire drop pod box full of my old pluck foam. So I just get a new one out every time, and that stuff's amazing. Somehow that's one of the best brushes I have.
That's legit stuff. The pluck foam, I love that.
Well, what you can do with this one little peg of the foam is with your fingernails, just tear it apart to get as small of an applicator as you want, and you want it to be irregular. Like, you want it to have look kind of craggy, you know, craters and stuff in it. You know, right there, all on the tip of what it is, and you can make that applicator be as small as you like. And depending on how much time you want to spend on this, depends on is what you're going to get with the layers. So what I like to do when I've got all the time in the world is start with a really, really dark color. That could even be black. Go and stipple on the black with the sponge, and then start building up layers from that. If you don't want to go black, I suggest a really, really dark brown, like a burnt umber.
That's where I would have gone with that, yeah.
A dryad bark. You know, I think something along those lines of brown. What's it called? Rhinoxide.
Rhinoxide. Yep.
Is what it's called now. But a really dark brown. So you could skip the black step if you'd like. But remember, these layers should be, you're working almost the bottom, whatever patch needs to be a little bit bigger, and then you're going to want to get your layers slightly smaller. This is what I mean. You're not really necessarily doing like a base coat and then highlight. You are just going right over the top, layering over where you did the previous color with this applicator.
This is all about contrast, right? The base you set below it will accentuate the color that you're trying to put on top of it, which is why the dark is really important to help, because the orange looks really bright. Like, you open the pot of Riza Rust, it looks super bright, and you think this is just kind of a goopy orange. That's not what rust is like. But once you apply it, and once, because the pigment is thin enough that the color underneath is going through it, you're going to start seeing how exactly that applies that rust effect, that dirty sort of orange color to it.
And if you don't want to go to full-on rust, you can stop at this black and brown step, and then you've got just dirty armor, some weathered armor dude's been going through the mud. And this works on top of anything. This technique works on top of any color. You could have a red marine, a blue marine. It could be on top of silver, a bolt gun metal. You know, lead belcher.
Rust is always rust. That's for sure.
Yeah, and who cares about science at this point? You're playing with spacemen. You don't need to know how things actually weathered. You can do it however you'd like it to be. And it's the colors.
The people need to know, Paul. The people need to know.
Well, I mean, you can get, I mean, that's where some of the oxide is for. And, you know, there's all kind of products out there. AK Interactive sells a ton of specific, very, very specific weathering products. If you want to have a winter engine grime, then you can buy the winter engine grime. I'm not even kidding.
This stuff's legit.
It's amazing. There's like swamp slimy green and like, Lower Alabama slimy greens, another one. Like,
I think like Tamiya makes it's not rust, but they make you know how we have like Battlemyre, Sterling Battlemyre, they make one, and I swear they make one for like Russian Battlemyre versus German gunk, and it's got, I mean, it's, dude, there is something, whatever you want, somebody makes it these days for modeling.
A lot of those products are enamel, and they're not acrylic or water-based, so you have to clean them up and use them differently. That's one of the reasons we don't talk about them a ton on the show, but in my Mechanicum army, I have a lot of those products used because I really do like their engine oil. Their engine oil has a different texture than just putting Nuln oil, but add black or something.
Oh, for sure.
I think those enamels really let you kind of spread your weathering. Anytime you get like an oily discharge or you're trying to get a weathering like that, I think that enamels actually give you a better, kind of a better result.
Well, realism is a big thing in those hobby circles.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, you can abandon all realism forever if you're with 40K, and no one's going to – people are just going to appreciate the way it looks. Nobody's going to be like, well, you know, it really wouldn't have rusted that way.
I don't like your term nobody because you know there's going to be that guy somewhere.
Well, Adam's not on the show today. I kid.
Adam gave me a real good tip, though. He said when he applies his weathering and stuff, like especially powders, like when he's putting on, because I have like a rust pigment that I use. He takes those little like your lady friend is doing her eyebrows or her eyelid.
I just learned something about you, Ricky.
Those, yeah, I don't wear makeup. Makeup applicators that they're kind of like on the end of a Q-tip kind of a thing.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Rounded, smooth sponge. Yeah.
Adam was telling me to take those and you use that to kind of draw it across the model, and you can get real good streaking. And I've used that pretty well, and it's pretty good.
That's probably a subject for – we're getting too far off from the rust topic, but that is definitely – you could – I mean, we could have – every single one of these segments can be on some aspect of weathering. I mean, that's absolutely true. So with that, you get the brown and then go with a really, really bright orange. And I think it's important to point out here that the brightness of the orange is completely fine. It's off-putting when you're looking at it originally. Like, how can I put this on my model? But once you've got these one or two layers down, this is going to be exactly what it needs to get the effect you're looking for.
There is definitely that that fear factor when you first put brush to your model. So just maybe practice it and get a little more comfortable. Well, it's terrifying to me. Yeah.
You can put this anywhere, and you can practice on anything. Like I said, it goes over any color. You got an old beat-up Marine you painted when you first started in the game. You break it out and rust his head up.
See, for me, like, it depends on the style of rust that you're going for. Like, if you want, like, a good chunky, flaky, thicker kind of, you know, oxidized rust, you know, like, that's something that I would grab maybe, like, a corner of a sprue and practice it in that corner, you know, caking it in there and maneuvering it around a little bit before you take it to your model. And that way you can get it, you can see it, and you can understand it. If you're doing more of a flat layer of colors and less texture to it, the RZA rust that Paul's talking about is going to give you innate texture. So, you know, you have that. But and the Typhus Corrosion underneath of it's brilliant. They work hand in hand together. But that's a little bit of a flatter layer if you apply it very sparingly. So, you know, the application of it, it's really, you know, how you want it to be. Do you want thick and gross? Do you want it, you know, fresh, a little bit flatter against the model? That, you know, that's just something to consider while applying it as well.
Start small. So to recap where we're at, get a piece of pluck foam or a small brush that you don't mind just getting beat up, and make the applicator as small as you'd like it to be. And as you get more confident with this, you could be doing with a fistful of sponge. And I mean, basically you're just covering up the whole model when you're doing this stipple because you've got confident with how the paint is. So would you dip it a little bit in the paint, then go to a paper towel, get most of the paint off. You want more than a dry brush than you would leave on than a dry brush, but not much more. And then do some quick dabs on the model and then go to that next color. And don't be right on top of it. You can be maybe a little bit left of it. You know, you'll start to work and play with it. Because, I mean, the only realism I'll inject in here is, like, this kind of stuff typically kind of spreads. Like, if you look at a rusted out car somewhere, you know, it's darker in one area and goes to a lighter color of rust.
Yeah, just Google rusty fender. You'll get plenty of source material.
Yeah, that's probably true. But it is very attainable with common products you probably got hanging out on your paint wall already. I said a dark brown, a black, and just a bright color orange. The orange that you got to paint one dude's hair with 3 years ago and has never come off the shelf again, you can use it for these types of things.
Yeah, for sure. And what I really love about rust, too, is it's something that doesn't catch your eye, but your eye notices it. So it's one of those things, you know, like the whole point of this whole segment is to take your models up a notch, right? That last little thing that you can do when you're gazing across an army that's just fresh painted. We'll just use Blood Angels because why not, right? Their armor's all shiny and clean and pretty and crap. And then the Death Guard come walking in and it just, there's something about it that just sets it apart from others. And that's what's neat about rust is it doesn't actually make it look any better, but it makes it look better.
Well, better subjective, to an extent. Right? But what right, I like yeah, is yeah. that it really you could put it's, it looks like you put a ton more effort into your army.
You did, there you
it looks
go.
Like you spent,
yeah.
It looks like you spent 4 hours on this figure instead of the hour and then 10 minutes of sponging that you did.
Yeah, I love it, man. And Rust is one of those things, too, that you can get so creative with it because, like Paul was mentioning, it travels and it does all these things, right? So it can be – or it's organic in itself in that aspect. So you get to really dictate what kind of Rust you're doing and how it's going about. Like, so I think that's fun.
And I said, you can put it anywhere. Rust over decals, doesn't matter. Water slide transfers, rust over them. Somebody's got a bolter, rust it. Guy standing in water on his base, rust his boot. You can do whatever you want with it.
That's what I'm talking about.
And just remember, do paint your whole model up and finish it before you do the rust. And you know, you want to start with a basically a clean, perfect model before you do your rust.
That's a good point. And this is, I mean, that's right in line with the finish and move segments. And these finish and move segments, we mentioned this on last show, and it's certainly in the show notes brought to us by Frontline Gaming. So happy to have them on board as a sponsor for this series of hobby topics.
Hey, I've heard of those guys.
They're awesome. I mean, they're doing stuff all over the place. Just happy to be able to talk about them the way as much as we have been recently on the show. Stuff with, you know, their events. Really excited about probably things to come and then with their products. And as we get more info about some of the exciting things they got going on, we're going to give our take on it here on the show outside of just the hobby segment, but definitely in relation to them believing in the show and the spot of that segment.
The new mats that they have, the Frontline Gaming mats, not the fat mats, because they're doing their own things. I mean, the fat mats are great. I own several of them. But the new mats that they have coming out, it's like HD fat mats. They look really, really good.
They probably have some things, at least let's just see up on their site and get you an idea of where they're going. Frontlinegaming.org, I think, is a place you can check out if you're curious about the things that we are talking about or just want to see where the next things are going.
And one more thing to talk about before we cut away from our awesome sponsors. Probably about a year ago, we talked about, like, we want to prove, like, the Southeast is a solid gaming group. And, you know, are we just as good as the Midwest? Well, this year, the ITC is being ranked in regions, so we get to prove that this year. So all of our listeners across the regions and even across the seas, there are different regions set up for the UK. That's all broken up. But all that's coming out this year in this season. So like, it's going to be really interesting to see numbers and stuff this year in that aspect and kind of bring bragging rights to the home team. So, you know, go get the points. Don't do it for yourself. Do it for your region.
That's nice.
Just hope that Justin Troop wasn't involved in drawing the boundaries for those regions because he's not great at geography.
Well, if Chris scores points, they're going to the West Coast. And then I will say at that point, I win. All right. Like, if you can see the smoke from California, you're on the West Coast. Chris.
I have to confess some sins here for a moment. I have a bunch of art that I just picked up, you know, over the years. That and then I just sit around. It doesn't get framed, and it just kind of sits there. Then I question, why do I have it? I need to go and get it up on the wall. So I have the Blood Angel print that came in the Space Hulk game. If you bought it directly from GW, they put that print in,
right?
And then I had the 25-year anniversary poster that you could get from stores. I'm pretty excited about that. And ordered frames for them. Well, since they're irregular sizes, I had to get a frame. And apparently I must have mismeasured by a quarter inch, 18th of an inch. And so it wouldn't fit in the frame after I got here. So I trimmed off a little sliver of the pictures.
For shame.
Blasphemous.
And now they're in those frames. And they look good.
I would have never said anything to anyone. Now everybody that's down in Paul Murphy's man cave and they're like, oh wow, look at that defiled piece of art.
I'm gonna take a tape measure every time and just like be like, seems a little short.
Not regulation
size poster right here, Paul. In fairness though, like those dang prints that have been coming out, you know, like with Fall Acadia and all that, every one of those prints are in the most obnoxiously weird size of anything. It's like not quite a notebook sheet, but
British,
it's not a
yeah,
it's European, like yeah. A7 and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's like not a real paper size.
That's what I want you to do. Like, whoever makes these things, go to Michaels.com. see what commonly sized frames are available, and then make whatever them in that.
Yeah. Like, why did you decide that that was the? I wonder if it come down to like their normal box size that they ship stuff in. Do you think maybe it was just so they would fit in the smaller boxes?
It could be. It definitely could be. But anyway, it's small price. But that's why this kind of stuff builds up for a year or two and doesn't get framed. And then right now it's all getting framed. And it may not be getting framed in a way that I'm proud of, but it's framed.
don't feel too bad. We were just rearranging the house here, and I moved a cabinet and found like 6 posters that I had placed back there to get framed. And I was like, I'll get to that eventually. Completely forgot I had them. And so at least you're doing something.
Well, I'm turning this whole area into just a nerd haven. And in my main area of my house, I've got all the Star Wars one sheets framed from the originals, the original trilogy Star Wars. And direct editions, artist edition. You spent a lot of time tracking them down. I was in the fan club a long time ago, Star Wars fan club.
Nerd.
That got me the Empire. And then I bought the Jedi and the Episode 1. I should say Episode 4 now. And so I want to get the new ones. I want to get Force Awakens and Rogue One in a certain style. I want the factory, you know, from the art company too, because I don't want to get a reprint off eBay or whatever. So those are going to hold it down here. And then I'm going to have a bunch of 40K and other not 40K stuff around it.
Well, it is good to have those sorts of motivational mojo things around your hobby space to just remind, you know, sometimes I just, you know, I need Sanguinius looking over my paint and telling me, you know what? You're trying really hard. You're doing really good.
Speaking of cool things, here's
some hope.
Forge World would at events, when they go to events, they have a binder of things that you can look at, and they will print you out a 5-foot tall, whatever chapter legion you want.
5 foot, you say?
There's tons of prints for sale there too.
Listen, I need to know, Paul, are you speaking? Is that hyperbole or
no.
Seriously, like 5 foot?
They have a book of things, of pictures, that you could say, I would like this printed and shipped to me as essentially a fathead. Something that
it's like a banner size, right?
It looks like the things like you could at Adepticon that was like, this event is going on here and this event is going on there.
Except it's a space marine and real close to actual size.
Yeah. Dopeness.
I need that in my life.
I don't think my wife's going to let that happen.
Just get something.
Not in my house.
Just like you need to like condition her, like just formally or ask her, or casually ask her, you know, like, and then narrow down what her legion profile would look like.
Yeah.
I don't know, Andrew. Like pretty Curtis's
sure
house.
Pretty sure she's a Night Lord.
I mean, think about Curtis's house though. Curtis has like stuff all through his house, nerdy as can be, but he's got like all these like classy minimalist prints of Star Wars behind his couch, like. Like you walk in there and the place looks amazing, and then you're like, oh wow, these are all like Star Wars and comic book posters, and he somehow made it look classy as all get out. So he's like my decorating inspiration right now. So I'm all
we're talking about that last couple weeks.
Lucky son of a golly.
just got to find the one, because I said this is my wife. As we share similar nerd things. Now she is not into 40K. I promise you that. But she
my wife threatens my model's sanctity if I leave them around or something. I don't know what word I'm looking for, but I get nervous. I sweat.
I'm pretty sure that's not the word you were thinking of.
my loving wife indulges me, and I'm a better person for it. It allows me to also indulge her in some of her hobbies. But I don't want to get too far off on a track here. I just wanted to express to everyone that you know that if you come here and you want to try to get one of these limited edition prints off of me, that they are slightly scratched on one side.
The Paul Murphy slightly used art gallery.
That's right.
Well, my Flesh Terrors one is framed, but the frame is broken.
In late 2015, I think it was December 2015, is when the Blood Angels Codex, the updated one, came out. Did you get one of the LE Codexes?
I did. I absolutely did.
Yeah. So as did I. So in there, there's, I think, maybe 5 or 6, and they're like 8.5 by 11, so like normal printer paper size. But there's these like beautiful prints that came as part of the codex, right? And they're like, there's some of them are like quotes, and then there's some other incredible stuff.
They've got quotes from the Book of Aphael. There's the Blood Angels and all the successor chapters that are listed in the codex have a tactical marine print on there.
Yeah. And they're really cool looking and just generally an awesome thing. Also, I'm not really sure what to do with them. You know, mine are still sitting in my LE Codex. I don't really know what to do with it.
I know what to do with them.
Yeah, I've got mine. I've got three of them on the wall behind me.
Bust out the
Exacto Blade. Like I just mentioned, my Flesh Terror one is all cracked and broken. I would like to say that was intentional and trying to stay true to the Flesh Terror's lore, but I'm going to have to blame that on Grav weaponry.
Earthquake from California.
What if you just like once a week replace one of your photos from like your wedding shrine that your wife inevitably will make and just put one of the Space Marines in there. See if she notices.
Wow.
See what could go wrong. That's a power move.
Space Marine themed Valentine's.
Established Dominus. Yeah, you got to establish Dominus, man.
Yeah, right, dude. I hope somebody's listening in their car right now with their wives riding shotgun being like, baby. There's no.
I don't even like this show. I don't know how it got on my podcast.
I can't turn. Where's the off button? I don't know. Someone hacked my phone and downloaded this.
The screen witnessed me and jump out the window. It's
the Russians, I swear.
Mediocre.
Oh man, if I could find a high def scan of the, you know, how the Forge World does the Space Marine, this armor they're showing off of a mark of armor. So, you know, they have those Blood Angels or any Legion where.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Just standing there with their arms down to their side or something. If I could find a high def scan of that, I would probably turn that into at least 10 fat heads that I could crank around my wall.
Now, if you go to the Forge World events, you can buy them from them there.
Yeah, like suit of armor?
I need it digitally, yes. So I can.
How much is this? I want that.
Yeah. Oh, they'll sell the fixtures right off the wall there, sure. I remember a long time ago, they had this limited edition Chaos art book that was sandwiched between two pieces of plexiglass, and then with bolted together. So it was two carved plexiglass pieces that all had this kind of weird demonic scenes on them. And they were bolted down. In between the book was the Chaos, combined Chaos book. And then it had a chain wrapped around that with a padlock on it.
I would want to buy that too.
I said, I want to buy that. They said, okay. So I
$7 jillion
without giving them any ability to backtrack off of that. Okay, I bought it. Took it out the car.
Yeah. I would not have just walked around with that. That'd be like you get robbed.
And pointy.
I imagine. Yeah. Cut yourself on a book. That'd be embarrassing.
A book of chaos.
Well, it'd be appropriate.
It's expected.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it should.
Traitor.
Look, sometimes you got to dance with the devil in the pale moonlight.
Speaking of dancing with the devil, man, I'll tell you what, working with metal models, that's dancing with the devil.
Yup.
Oh, dude, tell us about your conversions that you mentioned and you did it. You sent me a picture. It's amazing. Let's hear it.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I hate to tip my hand because this is what I'm playing at ATC this year and what I'll probably play at Warzone this year. But I recently came into the Siege of Rax book, the Forge World
Intelligence
book.
Leaks.
Yeah, exactly right. The Siege of Rax book has been made famous by a number of players and is most well known for the Renegade artillery lists and all the rest of it. But also buried in that Forge World book are the Death Corps of Krieg Death Riders. And the whole Death Corps of Krieg release, right? So if you want to play with the Krieg guys, the detachments and special rules are all in that same book. I have always loved the motif of heavy cavalry. And I just think it looks cool and it appeals to me. And so I've always really liked the Rough Rider models. Well, anyone who's read the actual Imperial Guard Codex knows that the Rough Riders are terrible, just gameplay-wise. They're just not worth their salt. But somebody tipped me off and said, hey, Andrew, you should go. And I'll tell you who it was. It was Adam Abramowitz, who's not here tonight and is best known for his painting skills. He is not known for his tabletop generalship or his list building.
Are you about to credit Adam with your list?
He absolutely inspired me to do this. And he was like, hey, look, because I was so excited about Rough Riders and I really want to play with these horses. And he like put me on a private call after like maybe three weeks or a month ago after we hung up after recording the show. He called me right back and we had been chatting earlier in the day. He's like, dude, what you need to do is check out the Siege of Rax. And so I popped it open and we like went through it together. And he's like, look at what these Death Riders do. And I couldn't believe how good they are. And point for point, and I'm about to say this and I mean it to my core, they are better or as good, if not better, than the Flesh Hounds of Khorne, the Khorne Dogs. They just are. That's an empirical fact.
Oh, they can deny psychic powers?
No. They're better.
This is one of those moments. moments where we just let Andrew wander off into massive hyperbole.
No, I'm just only asking. I'm just trying to set like a you know, where we're at.
Yeah. So I won't get into too far into the rules. Just sufficient to say that I was taken by the rules. They are absolutely incredible. It's 85 points for a squad of five guys. They're two wound models with 4+ saves and 6+ feel no pains, right? So just in terms of survivability against average shooting, they're
T3
they're,
or 4, sir.
They're T3.
So they get the 4 for being on a horse?
They just have a 4+ save, their carapace armor.
No, they get T4 for being mounted.
They have two wounds because they're mounted.
It's a mount, you know. It's not a bike, you know, so you get stronger the second you sit on a motorcycle. But I digress.
Exactly.
I feel stronger on a bike. Yeah. Have you ever sitting on a bike? Man,
that's the only reason people get bikes.
Yeah.
Horses don't. They don't give you the plus to the toughness, but they do give you a second wound, right? So they're cavalry. Two wound models, move 12 inches a turn. They reroll ones for dangerous terrain, so they're basically skilled rider, so you can move them. And when they assault, they have the lances, which give them +2 strength, +2 initiative, and are AP3, which means and they have frag grenades. The Death Riders have frag and crack grenades, which means that if I assault you through terrain, I have cavalry, so I ignore the distance modifier, I reroll dangerous terrain tests, and I swing at initiative 5. They're 2 attacks base, +1 on the charge. They're 3 attacks base, so a 5-man squad is 15 attacks at weapon skill 4. That's a huge deal, which means it's if you assault a standard Marine squad with a set of Death Riders, they will kill all of the Marines before the Marines swing at initiative 5.
It's a shame there isn't an abundance of strength 6 shooting to double those guys out from far away.
Well, and like I absolutely expect people to say that, like, oh, well, they're just going to get destroyed or whatever. But I'm going to bring 40 of them, and for about 700 or 800, a little under 800 points, and I'll bring 40 of them. And if you and then the rest of the army is still in.
I like your commitment there. Well, I like the commit.
It's a hard commit. So here's the real kicker, right? Okay, so even if you're going up against strength 6 shooting, and yes, that's a problem, but every single horse Death Rider squad, every squad of these horses, they're all objective secured because of the detachment. They all move 12 inches and they're incredibly effective in close combat. And then the other 1400 points of your army, or 12 or 1000 points of your army, is still an Imperial Guard army. So I've got 7 wyverns sitting in the backfield. Are you going to shoot at these horses? Great. That's awesome. Bombs away. I've got artillery carriages. Bombs away. You can't afford to shoot at horses while I'm bombing you with artillery carriages, ignoring cover with wyverns, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So yes, if you're going to drain that strength 6 shooting and try and pluck off my horses, great. That's so be it.
Having 2 wounds is pretty strong, because I was just thinking, well, you know, no, you're just going to psychic shriek that unit away and psychic shriek that unit away. But having 5 dudes is 10 wounds.
Yeah.
That would be difficult.
Absolutely. And they're veterans. So they're lead 8 with psychic shriek. Yes, and then they have feel no pain, 6+. But so we did the math on it, right? And say you've got a unit of cornhounds, and if you get the assault off on my horses, the cornhounds win. But if I get the assault off on your hounds, my riders win. And that's just how it goes. And so
even with 2 wounds on the fleshhounds.
Yeah, because I swing before you. I'm going to do 5 impact hits because I'm cavalry. You only have a 5+ save, presumptively, and I have 4+ and 6+ feel no pains. So my saves are better. We both hit each other. Well, dogs are weapon skill, what, 5?
5, yeah.
Yeah, so you're hitting me on 3s, wounding me on 3s. But then, you know, if I charge you, I hit you on 4s, wound you on 3s, at a higher initiative, and then you have to take instability checks. And we cost the exact same, right? 5 cornhounds costs 90 points. They are every bit as effective, in my opinion, as Fleshhounds of Khorne.
Well, I think the essence here is that the Fleshhounds fill a role in 40K right now.
Exactly.
They do something in 40K just by themselves.
Correct.
And they cost X points, and they have some sack of stats. What you're telling me, though, is that these other guys fill the Fleshhound role in an Imperial Guard army.
That's correct. That's exactly right. Well said. And I think importantly, these guys are objective secured, which is something that gives up a leg up. So they've performed the same battlefield role. But then you can't ignore them in terms of scoring. Anyway, that was a long story to basically explain why I've built this army, because I think it's going to be incredibly competitive. You know, I have kind of built a niche for myself in bringing meta busting or counterintuitive lists, whether it's the Dreadnoughts or the Five Storm Ravens or whatever. But the modeling project is what started this whole conversation. And I have been converting Attilan Rough Riders into Vestroian Rough Rider models. And what that includes is every time I get an old, if you can Google right now, if you don't know what I'm talking about, anybody who's been playing the game for a long time can picture the Attilan Rough Rider model in their head. It's got that pretty classic Mongolian looking.
If you've seen a Rough Rider, you've seen the model.
You've seen the model. Exactly right. But a big kind of chunk of that is they've got this big wide brim fur hats. And so I have been pretty meticulously going through and trimming with a pretty set of heavy duty sprue cutters, trimming off that brim, that big wide Attilan brim, cleaning it off the shoulders, and then taking green stuff and hand molding the Vestroian Cossack hat, which is another fur hat. But it's much, if you've seen kind of a Prussian Cossack or can picture the Vestroian, I've been making those hats by hand with green stuff. And as I mentioned to Chris earlier, I have 35 of these models and intend to get 40. And so when you convert, 25, 30, 35 old metal Attilan Rough Rider models into Vestroian Rough Rider models,
I will cheer you on for every game you play with those.
If it
was just like five dudes here, or maybe even just 15 dudes, I'd be like, Andrew, yeah, don't oversell it. But I mean, that's commitment right there. I respect that.
When you told me about it, and this is not any a slight on your prowess as a modeler or hobbyer or whatever, when you told me what you're going to do, I was like, he's going to show me, and I'm just going to have to yeah, man, that's good. You know,
pretend to be nice. Yeah, I'm looking at the Attilan Rough Riders right now, and I want to see a picture of every time you almost cut your finger off trying to get those hats off.
Where I was going is the model itself is cool and all, but it just is an old model, you know, and then he sends me this picture and it worked. It's perfect.
For anybody who's been kind of paying attention to Forge Narrative, I wrote a blog maybe last year. So I wrote a post about my Vestroian army and kind of how I did it start to finish. And I was conscious this time because I have a feeling, well, I'm very proud of how it's coming along. And Paul, that's high praise of you to say that. But I really want to share this project with everybody who's listening. And so I've been very conscious to take as many pictures in the work in progress stage as possible. And it's funny because when you hand model, and I'm doing it right now, I literally have the upper body of a Rough Rider in my hand. But when you do handcraft with green stuff models and do your own sculpting, it's very inconsistent, right? Every hat looks different, right? Every shoulder is sculpted a little bit different when you're doing it all by hand. And so I'm excited to kind of
do it.
Well,
not how the guard would do it.
To be fair, the Vestroians are actually a little different. They say that their rifles are handmade and passed down from generation to generation.
I'm giving you a hard time.
But I only say that to say that I'm excited with the end product. And I think that, I'll be happy to share it when it all gets done, and hopefully it looks as good as it plays, because I've done a couple of test games so far, and played a Tau player who is playing an optimized stealth cadre, and you can only shoot so many horses, and then I assault you and I sweep the entire Tau army, because that's just that you can't afford to ignore my artillery, right? Are you just going to not shoot at my artillery for two turns?
That's what you hope in those situations.
But yeah, right. I mean, cool. Kill the horses. If that's your bag, that's your bag. Whatever. But you're going to get bombed off the table if you do that. So far I've only played two games, but both with good results, and I've theory hammered it to death. And man, oh man, it's going to be a lot of people shell shocked when they get charged off the table with heavy cavalry.
Yeah, they're looking at this army from 2001.
Exactly right.
And want to know how that happened. How's this happening on round three?
Yeah, and I played my buddy, and then he sent me, if you guys remember the scene from Braveheart, if you can remember the scene, it's the first battle where they engage the British, and they go out and they're negotiating with the English generals, and the English general says something to the effect of, you know, Sterling, you have no
Battle of Sterling.
Is that I think one? It might be Battle of Sterling. And he says, you have no heavy horse. You have no heavy cavalry. And, you know, the Scottish say something and William Wallace is picking the fight. He says, no modern army has ever survived a charge of heavy horse. And I thought to myself, and so my buddy sent me that video clip right after our game. And I was like, yes, that's exactly how I intend to play this game.
I have to say, Adam talked about this in nauseam for weeks about a month ago. And every time he talked about it, I was just sitting here going, yeah, it's just not going to be that good. And then hearing how you're describing it and how you're layering it, I'm glad that you took the time to find the right pieces to fit the horses. Because in Adam's mind, all we heard was horses. The artillery backing it up and all that other stuff. I'm glad to see that you found a dual threat system for such a crazy idea. And bravo to you, sir. I still say I'm laughing at these little ponies coming across the table.
Yeah, dude. It's good. It's, but, it's,
well, look, it is absolutely... I'm just going to be playing Eldar that can shoot twice. So, I mean,
I was talking to somebody. We were talking about the new Uberdar and their double shooting nonsense. And don't even get me started on how terrible it is that Eldar got another upgrade. But, I said there was probably like five or six guys having this big, long conversation, and I was at work. And so I was kind of half keeping tabs on it. And then somebody said something about it. And I said, well, you know how you defeat that? You can't shoot twice if you get run down by a bunch of horses, because you don't get to shoot twice and after the assault phase. Anyway, I'm excited about it.
Yeah, it's the D size. I mean, so I think what we're all missing in our lives is being able to shoot D size twice.
I mean, that's what I've always felt. Yeah, really needs to happen.
Out of a raider.
That's the real kicker, is being able to put all the Eldar toys in Dark Eldar transports and call it
Howling Banshees now have a place somewhere somehow.
Yeah, absolutely. Incubi can now really be optimized because you don't, like, they're not a liability because you have the shooting to back them up in an efficient way. I'm sure we're going to talk about the Uberdar in a separate episode.
Especially when we get closer to having a better picture of the whole Gathering Storm and what it means. I mean, we're going to get more info coming up pretty soon, I think, about that last book, or the third book. I shouldn't say last.
It's when the storm maybe is done gathering, and then the storm starts storming
after that. But it would
be
really cool for, like, to get Gork and Mork involved in this in some way.
Yeah, let's give some love to those guys, right?
It's getting out of hand now where, you know, we're just not seeing, you know, and I know we're a big GW fanboy show, so I don't want to knock them too hard, but the absolute kind of obscurity that a lot of armies have slipped into is frustrating, especially, and by that I mean competitively, right? I mean, I guess
we can be critical of things, and I think it is fair to point out that what you're talking about slipped into obscurity that happens when you don't get releases or when you're not included in the big releases. I mean, like, if all we talk about are all the Eldar, all the Space Marines, and all the Chaos Marines, I mean, that covers a lot of bases. Like, that's got to be a high percentage of their people that purchase models.
Yeah, I mean,
fault there. But just the poor get poorer. The faction gets poorer even more.
You know, it's one thing also to have a large number of releases, right? I mean, we saw with the Bell releases more Tyranid stuff. Well, if I'm a Tyranid player and I get maybe four releases in 7th edition, and they're all just not competitive tabletop wise, I'm still very frustrated, right? I mean, even if you get attention from the company, I can see, you know, the orcs are one thing where they don't get any love. We haven't seen a release for them in 2 years, really. Imperial Guard, kind of similar situation. And then even the lesser codices that get attention, Dark Eldar, Tyranids, that kind of thing, they're like, well, this release does us no good. We're still relegated to Codex Twin Link Devourer. And that's very, very frustrating to see the rich get richer in terms of, you know, the Space Marines, Castellans of Imperium, Gathering Storm, all that stuff, more and more and more for the kind of the poster children. And then Eldar from a competitive setting is just so frustrating because they just get better and it's not fun.
God, and then if you're playing in an environment that limits what anything else, it pretty much always just means the Eldar get a little bit better.
In a world where if you're limiting things, right, the units or armies that are most efficient just innately are the ones who are hurt the least. And I think 99 times out of 100, that's the Eldar, right? Every time
we're not talking about anything new, so I don't want to get, right. I don't beat that up too much. I just want to point out that I would love this, that they slip in a fourth book or a Gathering Storm part, four or five or whatever, that has a big play with Gork and Mork.
Anything but Necrons, because screw those guys.
Gosh, I hate Necrons. I
like if we could get like a legit Satan again, something with actual like star goddish rules, that would be cool.
You mean like the OP cool one with the D shuffle? That guy was awesome.
That guy was crazy. I'm thinking a compromise between we have now and that.
You know what? To kill that guy, I had to throw Centurions in an Imperial Guard Valkyrie.
That's awesome.
You're welcome.
That's what I had to do.
Had to? You mean got to?
But awesome. Shake up. Like, what happens? Okay, let me paint a picture. What happens? We're not losing Terra, but maybe they blow up Mars. And outside of, and from the center of Mars comes out the dragon. And then we get Necrons involved.
I didn't know there was a dragon in 40K.
Yeah.
Yep, the dragon that is rumored to be on Mars.
Well, I'll be.
And look, and I don't know what's up with those Fallen in the leaks that we've seen, but to me they look bigger. They look bigger than regular Space Marines.
I just don't see it. I don't see it happening.
I think that there's a reason why those Marines are bigger. I don't know what it is, but I think there's a reason. And it could just be the grainy photo. I don't know. But I think
it's the photo.
Well, we'll see. I'm sticking by it not being a grainy photo.
All right. I will bet you a beer that grainy photo.
Okay. So you don't think, not talking about Cypher, the other guys.
The other guys.
I don't see it.
I think they look just like normal Marines in a grainy photo. I mean, I feel like we're arguing whether or not we saw Sasquatch.
Well, the one dude looks like a converted version of the guy that you get in the, what was it, like the 10 or the 12 pack from Death Watch?
Yeah, maybe he is.
It looks like identical to him, but like a quick arm swap or something.
We'll see.
And maybe that's just wishful thinking on my part, because here's the thing. I don't want true skill Marines. I mean, think about it. Like, I mean,
well, nobody's saying true skill.
Or you know what I'm saying? Like bigger Marines. Here's the thing. If we got bigger Marines in power armor, what that would do to people's collections. I mean, think about that. Like,
they'd have to be another faction.
Oh, yeah.
Or they're similar like the Custodes, or they're Thunder Warriors.
Mm-hmm. They're not Thunder Warriors.
But they're Fallen.
Yeah.
Feel the Tonda.
Of anybody who might feel betrayed by the Emperor, it's the Thunder Warriors. So why wouldn't they be Fallen?
Who are the Thunder Warriors? They were the
And I'm done.
Oh, you get me all warmed up, Andrew.
I literally have never heard those words together. Okay. We're going to go down this rabbit hole.
So, Thunder Warriors. These guys are the people that the Emperor created first to be his army to unify Terra.
Just the planet.
These guys are bigger and more powerful than Space Marines.
Ultimate Warrior in armor.
Yes, exactly. That's the best way.
To where yes, all the various kingdoms and fortifications on Earth are needed things more powerful than Space Marines to open up. I'd love to see a board game of unifying the Unification Wars of Terra.
It could be like a Risk, but not terrible.
Right. Risk is awesome.
No, it's not.
It's easy.
We could have an entire podcast about why Risk is not good.
All right.
Let's focus on Thunder Warriors.
While playing Risk.
Yeah.
Better than Monopoly.
So when the Thunder Warriors, they were rumored to have almost like an expiration date. So right after Terra was unified, all the Thunder Warriors, or most of the Thunder Warriors, died.
Okay.
That sounds a little suspicious to me.
Yep. Hopefully.
Sounds just like the Emperor, really.
Hopefully it sounds suspicious to you as well. Well, later on into the Heresy, you find out not all of them didn't die. Some of them went over and like almost had like a Thunder Warrior rebellion in another planet that the Luna Hounds.
No, not Luna Wolves.
It was the Warhound. The Warhounds.
Oh, so the pre-Angron World Eaters.
Right. Had to go over and dig them out. And they almost, the whole Legion couldn't dig out this handful of Thunder Warriors. Almost. They did win, but it was brutal. Then you go to a book called The Outcast Dead, to where some Marines that have broken out of the jail under the Imperial Palace run into a couple of Thunder Wolves. I'm sorry, Thunder Wolves.
Paul's
equally as strong.
His words all mixed up.
Ran into a couple of Thunder Warriors, and one of them beat half a dozen of them down with his bare hands of Marines.
It's pretty impressive.
I'm saying this, but they're bigger. They would be like a head and a half size taller and wider than a regular Space Marine is now.
What a Marine is to a human.
In size, but not in intellect or in adaptability. Like, Marines were basically the Swiss Army knife that the Emperor needed for any situation out in the galaxy. The Thunder Warriors had just one purpose, and that was to just be unstoppable, meaty monsters to conquer the planet and set up the birth of the Space Marine Legions.
Well, at the end of the Crusade, there's supposed to be a Space Marine on every planet acting as the ruler. So, I mean, that's the ideal. That's the end state. And you need a poet. You need an artist. A Space Marines can do all this kind of stuff. Thunder Warriors could not. Like, we're all that stuff, all that that frilly stuff has been turned into more beach-face stuff for a Thunder Warrior.
Gotcha.
So after their main job was done, they were exterminated. I don't think there's any way to not mean that they were taken out by their own people and left to die. So that's who the Thunder Warriors were.
I got
to
jump in for 2 seconds. Reese, I know you're listening, buddy, and you yelled at Frankie about a couple weeks ago. Have him listen to this segment. You're welcome.
So that is what I would love to see make a track back into 40K are these essentially proto-Marines making their way back into the fight. And that would be, they would be bigger. And if I'm right about these pictures and they're bigger Marines, I would bet that's what they are. They have some link to that.
Gotcha.
I don't know. The armor isn't right for Thunder Warriors, though.
No, but you can change your armor.
Yeah, but it's power armor. Like, all of a sudden, Chaos is just going to upscale it.
I mean, those aren't Chaos.
Well, yeah, you're right. I'm sorry.
Stop taking his moment, Ricky.
You know, you're right, Paul. It's your show. You're right. You're always right. Let's.
That's not Chaos. They're hanging out with Gilliam.
No, I'm saying, but they're there with Cypher. So where were they? That's what. Where would they have been?
You got to remember, Ricky here. He is a Dark Angels player, so he is basically just calling shenanigans. I think that the whole Cypher thing might be a little bit more benign than he is concerned about.
It's not benign.
I love Cypher. I think Cypher's a good guy. Even though I'm a Dark Angels player, I believe in Cypher. I don't know. I'm an optimist, guys. Yeah. I think he's trying to do the right thing.
Well, that sword on his back is clearly a Primarch's weapon.
Oh, yeah. That's Johnson's
sword. That's the Lion Sword.
But here's the thing. Can we talk?
It's broken in half, right?
Yeah, it was broken. Yeah.
It looks fixed to me.
Yeah. Well, it's been in that, even the old, you know, the old model and everything. That was always the thing, was he was trying to get to Terra. And that's the thing, is Cypher trying to get there to kill the Emperor, or is he trying to, you know, that's all the thing. The thing's always been, is he trying to kill the Emperor, or is he trying to save the Imperium? But everybody who thinks Cypher's a bad guy is neglecting to mention the fact that Cypher took out an Inquisitor who was investigating the Dark Angels and actually expunged all the records that they had anything to do with half of the, you know, the Unforgiven, you know, going over to Chaos. Why would he help the Dark Angels if he's not, you know, a good guy?
He also, like, teleports onto Abaddon's ship and screws with him quite a bit.
He's super duper good guy. I'm pretty pumped about some Cypher. I'm more excited about Cypher showing up than I am Gilliman.
I'm going to have to agree with that. Papa Smurf coming back. Yeah, it's cool, but he's a poser. I don't like him.
Oh my gosh. You Blood Angels fanboys. I don't understand your hatred that you have for Gilliman. He's awesome.
Well, all I'm saying is that there were two people in Ultramar.
So ho-hum.
Two Primarchs in Ultramar. One of them made it to Terra, and one of them was just late enough to survive.
Yeah, he's still alive, though.
No comeback, I see. Hmm.
Better to die for the Emperor than to live for yourself.
Oh my gosh.
Boo.
This guy's, he's going to change the face of 40K. There's no getting around it.
Going to. It's happening.
Yeah. And I'm just curious. I am more curious about the people that are around him. I could care less while the Grey Knight dude is there. But these
watch your mouth.
I've just got these theories. Got these theories.
You know, and those Grey Knight players, so salty.
Somebody sent me a screen capture, and I think it's from a White Dwarf. It might have already been released. I'm not sure. Of an interview with Matt Ward. And
about the Blood Angels? That's from a long time ago.
No, it's not about Blood Angels. It's about the Ultramarines.
And the quote is, "The Ultramarines are undoubtedly the best space marines ever. Yes, really. Thanks to the heritage of Gilliman and their myriad of heroic deeds, the Ultramarines are the exemplars of the space marines." And here's where it like just crushed me. He says, "With a few fringe exceptions who have severe mutations, parentheses blood angels, or stolid stubbornness, parentheses space wolves and dark angels, all space marine chapters want to be like the Ultramarines and recognize Gilliman and Marnius Kalgar as their spiritual lieges." And I was like, "No, I reject you, Matt Ward. That is terrible."
That's why Kalgar bent knee to Dante on Armageddon in the Second War.
Yeah, right?
Is this Matt Ward like ruining the fluff again?
I don't know.
That's from a long time ago. That's from one of the releases of the Space Marine Codex.
All right, well, good, but still upsetting that anyone published that nonsense, that drivel.
This drivel.
Someone doesn't know their fluff.
Yeah. So anyway, I know I'm not trying to tell tales or get anybody excited about things. I'm not chasing phantoms here. I just have some ideas on what would be cool if.
Yeah, but that's half the fun of these releases is having those conversations. I mean, you know, all they had to do was show one picture of Gilliman, and they almost broke the internet. I mean, I got people. I mean, how many conversations have we had ever since that picture come out about what in the world is getting ready to happen? So, I mean, it's exciting. I mean, golly, they really. Other than these Eldar getting stronger, they could do no wrong with me right now. They're killing it.
That's awesome. Well, guys, we are out of time. We went an hour, just about.
How about it?
Then we got. Then we
That's
got the
what
show.
I'm talking about.
I'm proud of us.
On the back of this, so please hang in. It's Cole Meaner, not Mike Chenal, me and Troop, and it's a real cool insight into what that they do and what they will be doing soon. I think you guys are going to want to tune in, at least to their properties to see what's coming down the pipe.
Giving the people what they want, man. Content.
Yeah, it's sure neato.
And this, we're coming into like, I don't know, trade show season for games. So it's going to be cool stuff coming out. Even some video games, man. I went to a Best Buy today to get ink for my printer to print out some army lists. And I saw a cool game coming out called, I'll find it for the next show.
Is it For Honor? Is that the one you're talking about?
No, it's like the remains of Edith Birch or something like that.
That sounds
you
like,
lost me.
That sounds like some movie like that my wife would make me go to.
What remains of Edith Finch?
No, that even worse sounds
that
like.
I saw that on Lifetime last week.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, just for that, we're going to hang in and hear about it for a second.
You're Peace welcome, out, folks.
Thanks, Justin.
What Remains of Edith Finch is a collection of short stories about a cursed family in Washington State. Each story offers a chance to experience the life of a different family member, with the stories ranging from 1900s to present day. The gameplay and tone is different based on the character, and the characters are varied. The only constants are that each is played from first-person perspective, and then each story ends with the family member's death.
Okay, that still sounds exactly like a Lifetime movie.
It's like JoJo's Bizarre Adventure meets a Lifetime movie.
Also, low-key, is it like just living in Washington State generally meaning you're cursed? Like, it's just like a terrible place to live.
It's just
like,
sad and it rains.
Man has a point.
This is like, I wouldn't live there. It's terrible.
Suicide right there.
As she explores the history of her family and tries to figure out why she's the last one of her family left alive.
People are just like desperately moving to other states because it's not great there.
Well, the graphics look cool, and the premise sounds cool. So, a lot of cool stuff coming on for gaming in general, not just for our hobby. But it's kind of cool that it's just a good time to be alive.
Seriously, who's making that game though? Lifetime or Hallmark?
Oh, I'm not even playing the game.
Oh man,
I'll check it out.
We have run the gamut with today's show. I mean, we've covered everything from. Home decor, rust and weathering makeup, and
horses.
Now Edith.
Horses.
Poor
yeah.
Edith.
Horses. This is the most ADD show ever, and I'm proud of it.
I blame Ricky.
I think you guys did great.
Clap hands.
Oh, yo, Ricky. I want to beg people again to please hang out for the next part of the show.
We did it. We broke Paul Murphy.
Yes. New high score.
I know we didn't have a kind of a set list of things to speak about tonight, but we got it. I think we covered some neat stuff. And hopefully, you know, at least when we talk about rumors that are completely – there's not even rumors. We're starting the rumors. There's nothing going on here. It's just fun to speculate about.
Sometimes anyway, people just like witty banter, Paul.
Yeah, so looking forward to all the neat things coming out. You guys have a good rest of y'all's night, and we will do this again next week.
Good night, Lou.
Forged Narrative is brought to you by Dicehead.com. www.dicehead.com. Games, hobby supplies, and comics. They have it all.
Hey everybody, welcome to a very special segment of Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host, and I got my man Justin Troop.
Oh yeah.
And joined tonight from CMON, Sir Michael Chenault.
Yes. Hello, Paul.
Man, thanks for joining me again. You know, you got a lot of cool stuff going on, and I like having you on as much as possible, as much as time allows for you to tell us about the neat things going on with Cool Mini. I mean, this is a company right in my backyard and just constantly releasing hit after hit.
Yep. Well, I mean, like, you know, we just got to nonstop keep, you know, pumping things out. We're growing very fast. I mean, even hell, a year ago when I was first on your show, actually probably longer than that, you know, we've almost doubled in size.
But it's on the back of success, like some very cool, I guess, games in all realm of gameplay. It's not just one type of thing here and there. You guys have a kind of a whole host of things.
Yep. You know, we have our focus on miniature games, war games. Euro games are, you know, getting to more of our spotlight as well.
Euro games, explain that.
So, you know, you have basically like those two types of board games that people like to view. You have Ameritrash, if you want to view it like that, which are kind of used as dice chucking kind of adventure games. And then you have Euro games, which people associate more of like there's no luck involved. This is all just pure strategy and things like that. You know, different games for different styles of people, but a lot of people for a long time, because our big hits were Zombicide, Arcadia Quest, they viewed us as a kind of like that Ameritrash company, and we're trying to branch out a bit more Euro style. Like one of our biggest successes over the last year has been Blood Rage by Eric Lang, which you can view as a hybrid kind of Ameritrash Euro game where it's very strategic and everything, but we still inject our signature cool looking Viking models into it from like Studio McVeigh.
And you're, these are actually like industry terms, a little bit of slang here. You're just describing.
Yeah, so, you know, in the board game community, you have Euro games, which are usually viewed as those diceless kind of strategy games where like, I won because I had the pure better plan and I outthought everyone. Power Grid and, you know, those type of games. And then you have your Ameritrash or Amerithrash, if you want to be a little less, you know, I guess, offensive. Some people view it as an offensive term or not, where, you know, you're going to have dice that are like you're chucking dice, you're being a little bit more exciting. You know, Zombicide, there's a lot of luck elements involved, and Euro games are kind of categorized by no luck, and Ameritrash games are categorized by, you know, throwing a lot of dice, having lots of luck elements in there, but usually are viewed as a bit more like kind of Hollywood cinematic style.
I mean, I like that. I mean, like, I like both elements of that. I think I like the thrill of, you know, rolling that 20 or whatever, and then I do like being able to kind of calculate out a plan. So, I mean, it sounds like a good idea to appeal to different types of gamers.
Yep. Well, I mean, it's a big world out there, and, you know, so we're just trying to open up our market more now that we have the resources and everything to do so.
So the miniature games you're talking about, things like, I mean, Zombicide, I guess, is technically a miniature, maybe not a war game, but definitely a miniature game. Dark Age, Wrath of Kings, and then you mentioned Blood Rage.
So Blood Rage is a board game, strictly a board game, but that is one of our ones that kind of teeters in between the realms of Euro gaming and Ameritrash, whatever you want to call it, because it's a Euro style game. There is no luck elements involved. It's a card drafting based game where you're playing different Viking clans trying to just pillage your way around the world. But a lot of Euro games are kind of categorized by not, you use wooden cubes or meeples or things like that. The components are kind of secondary in a lot of these games to the gameplay experience, but we wanted to make a really solid game that also had some really kick-ass miniatures. So that's where, you know, our kind of hybrid is coming to play.
And you do a lot of your advertising and sourcing on Kickstarter. And I think it's important to mention the success that you guys have had delivering, with just Kickstarter campaigns in general, but then delivering all the products to everyone. I think you've got some things that are getting delivered even as we speak. Is that right? Is this from the Rum and Bones?
We have, many projects that are being delivered right now. We have Arcadia Quest Inferno, which was the follow-up to, you know, Arcadia Quest, one of our top sellers. We have Rum and Bones Second Tide, which is a follow-up to Rum and Bones. We have Masmora, which is a spin-off game from Arcadia Quest that just finished up. That just finished up delivery. And then we had Xenos of Dreadmire, which is actually our card game, that just finished delivering out worldwide last week. So, you know, like the nature of Kickstarter, Our campaigns do tend to run into some delays and everything. We're trying to get better timetables and estimates, but you know, they are estimates. So when we're trying to estimate projected dates almost a year in advance. So a lot can happen in a year through the production pipeline, but we're trying to solidify our dates more. And, you know, that's the thing. You know, I'm not going to sit here and say like, oh, you know, we've not had delays and things that happen, but people come back to us consistently because we deliver a good product and you will get it. I mean, that's one of the risks of Kickstarter is that sometimes you'll back a project and, you know, it might not happen.
I can wholeheartedly stand behind you guys and say, you always deliver. I've bought into, God, I would say probably 75% of all your Kickstarters so far. Like you said, some delays. But one thing that you guys do a lot differently than some of these other companies, you're very transparent, though. And I think that's what really helps, you know, it eases me when I'm making the purchase. Because a lot of these times, you know, you're spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars on some of these really amazing products. And you know, that's scary, but you're so transparent and your track record speaks for itself. And I think for our listeners, you know, don't worry. If you see that CMON tag, you know you're getting something and you know you're getting quality.
Oh, yeah, we definitely have gone out of our way to make sure that, you know, Kickstarter is one of those things that you're buying almost into an experience with it. So we want to make it a grand, big experience because, yeah, anyone can just throw down some money and like, okay, in a year from now, I'll get something. But it's really when we do our campaigns that needs to feel like you've arrived at the carnival or the circus and you're in for that just huge, cool ride and everything from start to finish.
That's kind of felt with several of the things that I've got from you guys. Justin's on the show because he buys, like I said, everything that you guys offer up on Kickstarter and is constantly telling us about it. So I thought it'd be great to have him on and talk to one of the minds behind this awesome stuff. But games like Rum and Bones was an innovator at the time. And I want to talk a little briefly about that. I know Rum and Bones, the original one, has been out for a bit. And it was kind of patterned off of like computer games like League of Legends and games of that nature. But then this second generation of it is more than just a sequel to the game.
Right. So Rum and Bones was actually professionally one of the first board games I worked on. And my directive when that game came out was, hey, we've got a bunch of cool pirate miniatures and League of Legends is a thing right now. Those style of games are, you know, very popular. So we want to make a board game version of that. Rum and Bones was one of the first MOBA style board games, which is those style of games, multiplayer online battle arena that hit the market. And it was still very positively reviewed. It was actually Tom Vassell of the Dice Tower. It was his favorite pirate game of all time and actually was one of the games that he said introduced him to the concept of what MOBAs were. Because before, League of Legends is the biggest game on the planet. Riot Games is the biggest game company on the planet. But that was kind of still a very niche market. Now, the thing with Rum and Bones is that I still like the game just fine, but it also suffered from what we call pioneer effect, where, you know, you're the first one to do something. Therefore, you know, you're never going to do it the best the first time. It's very rare if that ever happens. And the thing for me is, like, we knew we were going to do a second season / expansion for it. And over the year and a half or so that game was out, you know, I had time to grow as a developer, designer. And also, I was seeing just a bunch of those style games coming on the market. And, you know, it's also one of those things like, oh, you know, that game does something kind of cool. Oh, that does something kind of cool. But none of them really felt like they, including Rum and Bones, they really fully grasped the potential of that style. And I knew eventually it was going to be one of those things like eventually a game is going to come out that does this way better. Like, that's just going to be the case.
Somebody's going to look at what you did, see the areas for, I don't even, improvement's not even a word, but see the area of innovation, an area for to innovate and then do
it. Well, improvement is a word to use as well, because again, like, nothing's perfect, especially the first thing. But yes, there's definitely so many areas to innovate. And so what it came down to was, you know, I had this conversation with our higher ups in the company and then our producers, and was like, well, we could release more of the same, or we could, you know, actually like design the better version. And it was actually one of our producers, Guillermo Goulart, is he's also one of the designers of Arcadia Quest. One of the producers at our company, he and I had a conversation about this, and he was the one that really pushed for it, of, you know, like, okay, well, let's, you know, if we're going to do this, let's do this. Like, let's not just make some minor changes here. Let's go all out and make it, you know, the full second version.
Let's trump those people that are working on it right now, whatever their innovation is, and come completely over the top.
Right, because if we don't do it, someone else is going to, and at that point, then you're left in the dust. So we redesigned the system from the ground up. I mean, when we did the second Kickstarter, we released a full upgrade pack to make everything compatible, because this is truly an addition change. And so we made an upgrade pack that was basically sold at a cost, because, you know, the game had just come out like a year and a half earlier, and that's a fairly quick turnaround time to be releasing a second edition. But we felt that it was the right move because, again, if we didn't do it, like we knew we had a better game on our hands.
And you're giving people a better experience. I mean, I think people will be cool with that.
Yes. And then that was one of the main pushes that we had, was we wanted to make it so you could buy this upgrade pack at a super cheap cost. We sold it for $15 in the Kickstarter to upgrade all the previous stuff you had and give you dashboards for all the heroes, 72 heroes, including the old Kickstarter exclusives. So even if you missed out on the Kickstarter, you could buy this and get the at least the dashboards for the heroes, the miniatures you still have to track down. And then, you know, we went to our board and the board of directors and everything and said, hey, so this is what we want to do. And the important thing was we wanted to sell this upgrade kit at cost, because we didn't want, you know, we didn't want people to go like, oh, so you just released a second version of the game and now we got to buy this thing for, you know, $40 just to play it. But our board was like, no, that's completely fine. Sell it at cost.
That's really great. So all those cool miniatures. When the game first came out, I was very impressed with the miniatures themselves. So you can still use those in this
version. Oh, yeah. Yes, absolutely. We had four factions that were released in the original Kickstarter. If you buy the upgrade kit, which I think is going to end up costing $20 at retail just to cover like shipping and things like that. But even then, for $20, you're getting 72 extra heroes to play with, four full-color decks of cards, new punch boards for all the objectives. Every single thing that we upgraded for the game, you're getting. Like, it's an insane value. And the box is like a brick. It's super heavy.
Can people get that somewhere right now?
No, because the Kickstarter literally just finished sending out the first wave of stuff to our backers. The game will hit retail shelves in Q2 of this year, sooner rather than later. So I can't give any dates because I just don't know them, but I know it's sometime in Q2. Okay. So a few more months and then you'll be able to pick that up. And yeah, the upgrade kit's one of the first things they'll be pushing out with it. Like right now though, like all of our Kickstarter backers are receiving their copy of the core game. Due to the raw amount of like stretch goals and stuff, we had to send it in two waves. But our backers will be receiving all the wave two stuff in late February or early March as soon as it arrives.
I mean, that's pretty cool. I mean, I think this, with that development, with the eye on the experience and the people that have already purchased the game, you don't see that from every company.
Will we be able to see the full game at like Adepticon and some of the other conventions that are coming out?
Oh, definitely by then we'll have it. Yeah. So, and the thing is, like right now, you can even go on the Kickstarter and all the upgraded files for the old stuff, you know, they're available on the website. Like there's on the Kickstarter as well. So if you're one of those people that wanted to just go and print that stuff out, you know, we've got the full rule book and all that stuff. You can go and print it and play right now if you want.
That's pretty cool. And that's the one that's one of the things that are getting delivered right now. But you actually just had a Kickstarter wrap up, which is The World of Smog, Rise of Moloch.
Yep. That was for our new Victorian, I don't want to use the word steampunk, but that's what people are going to call it anyway, dungeon crawl game. And it's a one versus many style game. So you're going to have one person controlling, in this game, it's called the Nemesis, where you're playing like the bad guy and controlling all those, the minions around the map and the monsters. And then you have the other players are controlling the gentlemen in service of Her Majesty's Empire, who are the heroes of the game. And the thing about that game that I really want to stress is that you have a lot of these kind of overlord style games. That's what they're called, where one person's playing the main enemy and the other people are playing the heroes, like Descent or Mansions of Madness 1.0 before they switched everything over to the app. And the big thing that was the stressing point for this game for us was in a lot of those games, the guy who's playing the overlord is kind of more playing the role of a dungeon master. You know, if you're trying to actively crush the players, you're probably going to do it really easily. And so therefore anyone who's playing that game, that role tends to have to temper what they're doing to make it more of that narrative feel. And that's just not really, you know, cool. So we did this with The Others as well, which is one of our previous games where we wanted to make it so if you're playing the overlord, you are actively trying to win against the players. And if you don't try your hardest, you will lose. And that's the same format we carried over to Rise of Moloch. And the thing about Rise of Moloch that I really like is that everything kind of has a parallel, where in some other one versus many games, if you're playing the overlord, it's going to be a drastic different game experience than if you're controlling a hero. And here I made the comparison a lot during the Kickstarter, calling it the Dark Mirror, where everything the Nemesis was doing was just a kind of flipped version of what the gentlemen and the heroes did. So therefore, in between games, you could switch up who's controlling the nemesis and who's controlling a hero or whatnot. And it would be, you know, you could switch in those roles very easily, where in some of these other games, because the Overlord plays so drastically different, it usually ends up happening where whoever owns the game is the one that has to play that role, because otherwise it's too complicated for just another person to just drop into.
That's one thing that I love about the game systems that you guys specifically design, is you put that level of thought into it where it's not so overly complicated. It's got the depth and it's got the engagement, but you know, it doesn't take a freaking rocket scientist to figure out how to play it.
Well, we've had people that, you know, yes, we definitely want to cater to a large demographic. And we've had some people that go like, well, your games are very shallow. And that comes down to a matter of opinion. I mean, some people really want those super in-depth games, you know, like Twilight Imperium is a board game that takes 13 to forever to play. Some people really, really like that level of depth. And, you know, some people like Zombicide. Like, I'm not going to say Zombicide is a deep game, but it's fun. So you can go and just throw dice, kill zombies, and just have fun doing it.
There's a lot of value to be able to break out a game in a crowd of people, maybe at a party or a social gathering, that are not traditional gamers.
Yep. And we are, you know, expanding our repertoire of games as well. Like, so Paolo Mori is one of my favorite designers. I've got kind of a designer crush on him. And he has designed two games for us, Dogs of War, which unfortunately was not one of our bigger commercial successes, but in my opinion, it is my favorite game that we have made. I absolutely love that game, and it's straight Euro game. But he is also coming up with another game that we are releasing fairly soon. I don't know the exact time, but definitely the next couple months, called Ethnos. And it is a drafting style. It's a drafting game where you are basically in this fantasy world and you are trying to claim territories, and you do that via drafting different types of characters and monsters via cards. And so you're trying to get, it's like set collection where I'm trying to gather these different types of monsters, but I also gain bonuses for getting a variety, and it's points accrual. It's kind of hard to describe, but I'm not even going to try to really just end up describing it, but it's one of my favorite games that we have coming out. And I absolutely have a blast every time I play it. And it's one of those games that's elegant is a word that gets thrown a lot in the industry, that it's very simple, but has a lot of depth to it. And that's how I feel about this one. It's actually one of my favorite ones coming out. And actually, on the topic of games coming out, there is another game, one more that I'll mention very briefly, that is coming out soon, called a Gang Rush Breakout. And that's a game I did development on. And what I can call that game is basically Mario Kart, the board game. So
sold.
you are playing, each person is playing and this is by no means a very deep game, but it's super fun because it's Mario Kart. It's not super deep, but it's really cool. You're playing these different gangsters who are, the board itself is a giant bridge. And so you start at one end of the bridge and you are trying to make it to the other end. But it's not just a race. You're trying to also pick up the most cash via shooting the other cars, driving over power-ups and things like that before you cross the finish line. And every round, you can do stuff like drop caltrops on other cars. You can summon police officers that are going to like start shooting at them to deal them damage. You can drop actually like giant like shipping crates on the track, so you've got to swerve out of the way real quick.
What is this, a miniature type game? Is it, are you moving figures and tokens, or what's the feel of this game?
Yeah, it's a miniature style game, but like not super heavy. You're gonna have like five car miniatures and then some little three. So anyone's familiar with the old Thunder Road game from the 80s, the board kind of looks like that, where it's just a bridge with five lanes in it, and you're controlling five different cars that have five different miniatures. And then we have, in the box, you have little 3D hindrances or whatnot, like the shipping crates are little pop-up 3D pieces. You've got, I don't know what those, like, do not cross signs are, like, you know, that they put around, like, police, like, areas, the crossing guard signs. You've got you can drop down. And then you just have different tokens you can run over for different power-ups. Like, you can actually, each car has a different power as well. Like, one of them can, like, actually, there's an old truck that can ram into cars and, like, push them off the bridge or push them into obstacles.
And some other player is controlling these to kind of...
It's a complete versus game. So it's 2 to 5 players. You're each controlling a different car, and the game plays, like, half an hour. You're just trying to, like, race across the board and, you know, get as many cash as you can, buy power-ups, and just generally screw with the other players.
I like that. That sounds neat. How does one come up with that concept? If you, from a developer side,
Well, so that one was designed by a partner company that we actually teamed up with, Akima. And so they basically brought the game to us, and we were the publisher for it, and they wanted us to do development on it. So we didn't design the game. They brought the game design to us, and then it goes to our development division, which I'm a part of. And we basically play it and go like, okay, these are the issues that we found. These are the things that could be improved. These are the things we like. And then it's a back and forth between the designers and us about, you know, finding that compromise of keeping the vision of the game and also making sure it's as tight and streamlined as we can.
Well, it is. It sounds pretty cool.
It's
we talked a little bit about Kickstarters. I think, is there another one coming up soon that people might be able to get interested in? Maybe give us a little teaser.
So we at the end of every one of our Kickstarters, we do announce our next project. And our next one is actually Rising Sun by Eric Lang. And that game has single-handed, like we showed the miniatures in the game off at Gen Con last year. And it has been one of the most hyped games over the last year because, first off, Eric Lang is a legendary designer. He's been working more and more with us over the last few years. Blood Rage was the last game that he came out with, or the last game that we came out with him. And it was immediately a classic. I think Blood Rage is currently ranked in I think it's in the top 10 board games on Board Game Geek. It's like in the top 10 of all time.
Wow.
Actually, I will look that up now. I know it's in the top 20. I believe it's broken top 10. It is the 15th game ranked overall on Board Game Geek. Of every game on the site. So the number one site for board gaming out there, Blood Rage, is ranked number 15.
Holy crap.
And this is
that's big news. I mean, that is big.
Oh, yes. And it's a fantastic game. Rising Sun is the successor game to that. And what I mean by that is that basically it's done by Eric Lang. The art is all done by Adrian Smith. The miniatures are all done by Mike McVay. This is not Blood Rage 2.0, so don't get that, you know, impression there. This is, while it carries some of the same themes and it's the same designer, same company and all that, this is basically the next project that's, you know, coming out from that style of game. So whereas Blood Rage was Vikings, and Eric likes to say that it had its history in Risk, kind of like that Area Control, with Rising Sun, the game is focused more on honorable combat and controlling lands and negotiations versus Blood Rage, which is Vikings go and kill and bring about Ragnarok. This one is set in feudal Japan, definitely with the mystical stuff like that. And you have Onis and dragons and stuff you can summon. But it is much more, I'm not going to say tactical because they're both very tactical games, but Rising Sun is definitely has more kind of negotiation. It's not a full, like, just nothing but negotiation, but you can make alliances, break alliances. And it's definitely thinking ahead and, you know, planning how all of your actions are going to affect all other players.
Is this going to be a full-on miniature pay type game also, or is it tokens, meeples?
This is a full board game, but just so Blood Rage has been touted as having some of the best miniatures of any board game that's been released. And for what we did for Vikings there, we're doing for Samurai and feudal mythical Japan here. So you can actually go to the Facebook page for Rising Sun. We've been spoiling miniatures for the last few months and just see all the incredible stuff here. And actually, Paul, I will link you to the last post on the World of Smog, where we, at the end of the campaign, when we announced the start date, which is March 7th at 3 p.m., for Rising Sun, you can actually scroll to the bottom here and you will see some examples of the miniatures that will be in that Kickstarter campaign, specifically our dragon.
Yeah, I've already seen some of these things, and Paul and all the listeners, like, you need to look at these things. They are some of the best sculpts in the history of just miniatures, period.
Well, you mentioned Mike Bay.
Yeah. Like, yep. This is his best work. Like, he's done great things in the past, but, like, to me, aesthetically, and I'm not really too big on, like, the Far East or anything like that, but this is just so appealing, and looking at the art of the sculpts and the cuts and the designs and the flow of the miniatures, this is top-notch.
Holy crap.
Mike McVay is, like, one of those geniuses that every time he releases something, it is just the best work he's done. Like, it's always perpetually just moving forward with
Mr. McVay. There's, like, a really cool dragon here like crawling around a ball of fire. It's hard to describe, but it is worth looking at. Can I put this picture in the post when I make this?
Yeah, that was posted on the last update for our Kickstarter and is full public knowledge.
Check out the show notes whenever you hear this and find this image if you have not seen it before. It's very cool. Man, that's pretty neat. I know I'd not seen this before, and this is epic. It's blowing me away. I mean, this goes back to what I was talking about at the very, very beginning of the show. Just the absolute quality and the you guys seem to be really focused on the experience of you of the consumer, the gamer, your customer, and a lot of the design, the thought behind the design, and things like this all play into that.
Well, so that is one of the main like driving points for any time we make a game is that. We want to make an experience for the player. You know, we want to make it so every time you were coming into one of our games, you're going to come away with a different experience, you know, tailored to what this should bring. Like with Rum and Bones, specifically, we wanted you to feel like you're in the middle of a pirate movie, like specifically just like swinging back and forth on the riggings, landing and like just, you know, cutting through a swath of guys. And you can just hear like the Pirates of the Caribbean theme song in the background, like playing. With Zombicide, we wanted to make it so you have that tense, you know. Zombicide, I always love describing to people at conventions when they've never played the game or anything. I always, when I'm demoing the game, I say, hey, you know all those zombie movies? And you watch them and you're yelling at the guy like, don't do that. That's an idiot move. Why are you doing that? This is your chance to not do things like that. And I swear, like 9 out of 10 times, someone goes and kicks down a door and all of a sudden a bunch of zombies swarm on them. And I just look at them and go like, hey, you know how you thought that you would survive the zombie movies because you were way smarter than all the other people in those movies? You just got dead. But so again, like
hard. It is one of the hardest games I've ever played. I love it. It's one of those like you challenge yourself to think smarter and make better decisions, but you never do. It's exactly what you're saying.
Right. And like with Xenoshift, we want you to feel like you're on a set of Aliens or Starship Troopers where, you know, game over, man, game over. Like it's just gonna be constantly odds against you. So and, you know, Blood Rage, we want you to feel like you're just, you know, epic Vikings and everything going and just bringing about Ragnarok and, you know, pillaging and everything. So, again, all of our games, we want them to be very unique experiences. But that's the most important thing is we want these games to craft experiences for the player.
I like that. You guys are kind of mainstays at some of the larger conventions, too. I've seen your booths. You always put a lot of time into them and neat things that begin to make it an experience in general while people are even at there talking to you. What's the next thing you're going to be at?
So we just finished up the Las Vegas Open last weekend. And if I remember correctly, as far as our schedule goes, the next major show is Adepticon, which is a miniature focused show. So we'll have Dark Age and Wrath of Kings out there. We'll have our board games and everything as well. But the main focus of that show is the miniature games.
People, if you haven't already stopped by their booth, make sure you make plan a trip to do so. I can see because you guys have painted examples of all your miniatures, too. So it's kind of cool to see these as game pieces, but it's also kind of cool to see them as works of art.
Oh, yes. So we definitely have gone out of our way to, you know, we bring all of our painted miniatures that we can to the conventions and everything. A lot of them. So we have two major painters for our company. We have Jen Haley, who is, in my opinion, the best painter in the United States. And then we have Big Child Productions, who is actually a lot of these sculptors for a lot of our miniatures, for our miniature games and some of our board games as well. Actually, Big Child did all the paint sculpting for Rum and Bones, and they do all the sculpting for Dark Age as well, and the painting for that. So those are two resources that we tap for all those.
It's amazing looking stuff, man. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about before we wrap up? I mean, I know it's probably hard to, I mean, we covered a lot because there's so many things in the works for you guys. What's the website that people can check out the games we've talked about so far?
That'd be coolminiornot.com. And actually cmon.com as well is our commercial site that'll have more of like kind of a catalog feel to it where you can browse through all of our stuff. And then you'll have the, you know, would you like to know more panels that'll take you to all that. And definitely our Facebook page. That's the best way to keep up to date on our Kickstarters and when things will be launching and things like that. And as far as like additional stuff to talk about, Paul, man, yeah, there definitely is. But unfortunately, so the big project that I have been working on for the last year plus is unfortunately I can't give any information about it out. So this is like the world's biggest tease here because I can't give any hints about any of it because it would actually reveal too much.
You'll have to come back.
I thought about this well before.
Yeah, after you revealed it, you'll have to come back.
I will. And so what I will say is that Gamma is one of the largest trade shows for the industry, and that happens in this kind of middle of March. And we have some very, very substantial announcements that are going to happen at Gamma. And it would not surprise me if some of these announcements just, I can't even talk about the amount of shockwave that they'll probably cause.
Pretty cool. So people will see it on your Facebook, right? If they follow Gamma as a whole, I'm sure we'll see it on the social media.
Yes.
And then we'll catch up at Adepticon or thereafter and talk about it if that's all right with you.
Yes. And so, I don't know if I personally will be at Adepticon. Because of the development schedule that we have, but I'm absolutely fine to be back on the show and talk about all that in rabid, insane detail about like, hey, Paul, you know, like last time when I said I couldn't say anything, well, now I can talk about it. So
I can't wait, man. I'm excited just thinking about it. Well, Michael, man, thanks a lot for coming on tonight. Justin, is there anything you'd like to gush over and share what your favorite game you've got up there so far is?
I'm going to say, hands down, it's Zombicide. But specifically the Black Plague, it's touched like that inner nerddom so much more. Zombicide itself was a great game, but I find myself just in the Black Plague a lot more. But I just want to say, thank you to you and to your whole team and everybody that's involved. You guys really do deliver an experience. And we as gamers and stuff like that, that's what we're looking for. We're looking for this alternate world that we can delve into. And I will say, hands down, thousands of dollars invested in your product, that you guys are, top notch, one of the best at delivering that experience. So to you, sir, and to your, compadres, I just want to say thank you.
Oh, well, you're absolutely welcome, Justin. I'll make sure to pass that along to the rest of the team.
Have a good rest of your night, Michael.
All right, Paul, good talking to you as always.
I see dead people.